Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. We're going to be continuing our series on the history of Chinese in California. We're going to continue our story by moving into the age of exclusion and violence. Let's get started. While many Americans might be familiar with the Chinese Exclusion Act, less is commonly known about the vigilante violence that occurred against Chinese immigrants all across the country, but particularly in California. In our last episode, we discussed the rise of scapegoating against the Chinese, with many white Americans blaming the Chinese for the economic malaise that the state was in due to increased competition by the flattening of the world as a result of the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad. The process of scapegoating is tantamount to the process of assembling logs and kindling, the groundwork for violence. All that was needed now was the ember, an inciting incident to start a violent conflagration. One of the most savage events that took place in California was in Los Angeles in 1871. The incident actually started as an altercation between Chinese individuals. There were guns and a crowd of spectators. During the fight, a stray bullet from the altercation between Chinese individuals hit an onlooker, and a riot ensued. All Chinese were now targets, as this misfire made it open season for many of the spectators. Here's a description from a great blog post about the incident that was published by the Los Angeles Public Library. In October 1871, tensions were running high in Chinatown because of a feud between two leaders of two rival Hunan, or mutual benefit associations, over the kidnapping of a young Chinese woman. A shootout between several Chinese men broke out in the middle of Negro Alley. The ensuing response by two police officers resulted in the wounding of one of the officers and the death of a civilian who assisted the officers, Robert Thompson. The shooters took cover in the Cornell Building. Word quickly spread that the Chinese had killed Thompson, a popular former saloon owner. A mob of rioters quickly grew to 500 people, 10% of the total population of Los Angeles. The rioters forced the Chinese out of the Cornell Building and dragged the captured Chinese to a makeshift gallows at Tomlinson's Corral and Goler's Wagon Shop. When John Goler protested that his children were present, a rioter pressed a gun to his face and said, "Dry up, you son of a bitch." After Goler's portico crossbar was filled with seven hanging bodies, the crowd dragged three more victims to the nearby freight wagon and hung them from the high side of the wagon. While there are varying accounts of what exactly transpired, there is no disputing the brutality and the savagery of that night. The next morning, 17 bodies were laid out in the jail yard, grim evidence of the horrific events of the previous night. The 18th victim, the first man hanged, had been buried the night before. 10% of the Chinese population had been killed. One of these Chinese caught up in the mob violence was respected Dr. Jean Tong. In fact, of the killed, only one was thought to have participated in the original gunfight. Though a grand jury returned 25 indictments for the murder of the Chinese, only 10 men stood trial. Eight rioters were convicted on manslaughter charges, but the charges were overturned on a legal technicality, and the defendants were never retried. The tragedy was quickly forgotten. The local newspapers made no mention of it in the year and the recap of the major events. The unfortunate truth is little changed in Los Angeles as a result of the massacre on October 24, 1871. The massacre did not result in racial tolerance. In fact, anti-Chinese sentiment increased in the following years, and the Anti-Coolie Club was formed in 1876, counting many prominent citizens among its members, and the newspapers quickly resumed their editorial attacks against the Chinese, end quote. Another incident occurred in Truckee, California. On June 18, 1876, a posse of men left a local saloon and made a beeline to where Chinese laborers were sleeping. Members of the community had told them that they weren't welcome and needed to leave town before something happened. The Chinese laborers either didn't understand or discounted the threats, perhaps having grown used to them as the target of regular prejudice. These laborers were cutting wood for a local white man when a posse arrived just after midnight. They were fast asleep in two small cabins at the end of the road. The posse surrounded the cabins. They poured tar on the roof and lit it. The fire turned into a roaring conflagration, waking Chinese laborers who ran out of the cabins and proceeded to try to put the fire out. At this point, the posse had opened fire, seriously wounding one and minorly wounding others, before the laborers escaped into the darkness of the surrounding woods. Feeling confident, the posse continued their violent course by attacking a Chinese labor camp next. Fortunately, only one person was killed in the incident. The survivors of these two attacks went straight to the local constables to report what had happened. Given the public and unprovoked nature of the incident, detectives were dispatched from Nevada City to investigate. The town, however, was so tight-lipped that they needed to develop a reward from a local businessman, the governor, and some members of the Chinese community to get people to talk. As the investigation progressed, the tension increased in tandem. The local constable received death threats, which had the effect of inciting his interest in solving the case even more. The Central Pacific Railroad even got involved, sending one of their best investigators to support the constable in his pursuit. With all these resources and mounting pressure to resolve the case, a resolution was inevitable. However, once the culprits were caught, the trial turned into a major spectacle. Most of the men that were involved in the posse were charged with arson, but one man, William O'Neill, was charged with murder. O'Neill was an employee of the Central Pacific Railroad and a recent arrival to the Truckee community. The trial had lots of ups and downs and interesting moments that could be its own podcast episode itself. But ultimately, we must pass by these details to the conclusion. O'Neill was acquitted on the murder charge, and the arson charges were dropped. These acquittals, which was a sign of the state of white supremacy in California, was surprisingly received poorly by the rest of the state, at least in the newspapers. The Reno Evening Gazette suggested that the case was rigged and that the court was one of those kangaroo varieties. The Sacramento Daily followed along with a similar tone, suggesting that the whole community of Truckee was corrupt. Even after all the notoriety, Chinese Americans continued to migrate to that area, and believe it or not, Chinatown was burned down again just 2 years later in 1878. This time, it was not rebuilt, and the whole community gathered after the Chinese had left to celebrate the dismantling of Chinatown. Children were seen throwing rocks at Chinese refugees as they slowly migrated out of the community. This is just one incident of many that we know about. It's important to use the phrase "that we know about" because many incidents were not likely recorded or documented. There are likely unmarked graves scattered across the state of California. The moment of anti-Chinese energy ultimately concluded in the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. A bit of history for your context about how this regional issue became a national one is important here. In 1868, the U.S. government signed the Burlingame Treaty between the United States and China. Before this time, China was heavily constrained by treaties that it had been forced to sign at the conclusion of the Opium Wars. The goal of this new treaty was to mutually recognize sovereignty and create an open pathway for migration. Idealistic in nature, the treaty added fuel to the fire of the anti-Chinese sentiment that was growing on the West Coast. This treaty was the opposite of what Californians wanted. They wanted the valve closed. They wanted the valve closed, but instead, the U.S. government wanted to open it completely. Given the growing and loud opposition to the immigration of Chinese into California, The treaty was ultimately revised 12 years later. The revision gave the U.S. the flexibility to limit the flow of immigration through regulation, limiting, or suspension. Ultimately, the revision was a first step in the final conclusion of exclusion. Discussion began about exclusion in Congress in the early 1880s. Immigration is a federal domain, meaning that Californians who wanted to stop immigration needed to deal with the federal government. Western states, working as a kind of xenophobic bloc, petitioned at first and then demanded action be taken on the issue. Given the growing population and hence the political power of the Western states, both parties mobilized to appease their needs and requests. It also helped that both parties were deeply xenophobic at this point in time. The initial bill that would become the Chinese Exclusion Act included a 20-year exclusionary period, which was vetoed by President Chester A. Arthur, a somewhat forgotten president in American history, but who was ultimately famous for the passage of the Pendleton Act, which brought an end to the era of the spoil system and replaced it with something that tried to resemble merit. After vetoing the first version, Congress revised it and voted on a 10-year exclusionary period, which Arthur gladly signed into law. Let's get into the specifics of the Chinese Exclusion Act before discussing its impact on California. The act suspended the immigration of Chinese laborers for 10 years. This applied to all types of laborers, both skilled and unskilled, industrial and agricultural. However, it's inaccurate to say that the Chinese Exclusion Act banned all Chinese immigration. Instead, it focused on banning laborers as a way to limit immigration and to support white workers in California, those who complained about Chinese immigrants taking lower wages. It is significant and worth mentioning here that this was the first immigration law to target a specific group of people based on nationality and race. Now, there were groups of Chinese immigrants who were allowed in, but whether they fell into a banned or permitted category was often up to immigration officials. The exempt categories included merchants, teachers, students, diplomats, and tourists. Upon entry, officials could question and choose to either believe or disbelieve the story they were told. A Chinese immigrant could state that they were a merchant to gain entry while intending to work in the world of manual labor. Another feature of the law was that Chinese immigrants were ineligible for naturalization. Chinese immigrants who entered after this passage of this act occupied this strange third space where they were simultaneously permanent residents but were excluded from the benefits of citizenship. While the law did allow Chinese residents to leave and return later, it created new hurdles for reentry. Documents could easily be challenged in the same way that the professions were. The impact was that families could easily get separated. This leads us to our last point for the episode, which is the burden of proof. While immigration would continue to evolve and require more paperwork and documentation, the Chinese Exclusion Act was a major inflection point in the history of immigration bureaucracy. No longer was it sufficient to declare one's status. The burden of proof of one's status shifted away from the government toward the immigrant. Documentation became the currency. Next time, we will conclude our discussion of the Chinese Exclusion Act and move into discussing the effects on California and the Chinese Americans and immigrants living there. We'll see you next time. Thank you.